Mr. Macmillan, reel 8. You're talking about your tea. Were you able to get tea at any time of the day? A cup of tea any time of the day?
Well, you had your tea at the proper... You had a 10 o'clock and a break in the afternoon. But there was nothing to stop you going up, providing you weren't seeing someone. You could have a cup of cocoa or that. A great favourite that I found out was sultana cake. Why, I don't know until this day, but everyone seemed to want a piece of sultana cake. on a Saturday and Sunday, we used to try and give the cooks a rest. So, on a Saturday, it was normally herrings in tomato sauce, which come in rather big tins. And I think at night time, so as they wouldn't have to cook again, we had corned beef and piccalilli. That gave them a bit of a break. Sunday dinner they cooked, and I think Sunday night was a piece of cake. That gives them, the cooks, a little bit of a break. Because believe me, they worked damn hard, them lads. I still don't know until this day how they done it, but never mind. They were very good. And with having the two cooks of the ship in our mess, we got rather little better treatment, let's say, than the rest of the ship. Well, meals were good, quite wholesome. The corned beef was three bent or some of the beef in the big tins, you know, the massive tin, and the big jars of piccalilli with all the bits and pieces in it. That was that. Bread and butter, plenty. No problem there. Later on, a shortage. Well, that will come later on. But the living in those days, I think it was actually better than a lot of people had living in homes. In their own
the normal
home.
Population.
Yes, I believe it was. I think we were fed better as well. When you think of we were getting paid, we were getting fed, we were well looked after, we had good clothes, we were seeing a bit of the world, free, which a lot of people would never get.
How did the punishment routine work? If someone stepped out of line and had to be punished.
Now, once again, we've got to separate a line here between peace and war. It keeps cropping up, but it's got to be. If you've done anything wrong, really wrong, the coxswain, he acted as what you would call the regulating petty officer, who looked after the punishment, and he would take you in front of your divisional officer. You had an officer that maybe looked after the signals for complaints or the seamen or the stokers or whatnot. And if he thought it warranted, you'd go before the captain, and you would go to his table, take your hat off, tuck it under your left arm. The coxswain would read out the charge. Your divisional officer would see, give a little bit towards your character, whether you were good, bad, or what. And then I think, myself, before you got there, your punishment was decided. You know, it could be stoppage of pay, stoppage of leave, serious crimes, you were discharged to a prison. But when we come later on, you will laugh at some of the things I'm going to tell you later on. It wasn't too severe. Not really.
Fatigues, what army called junkers, was that part of punishments?
Well,
you did a lot of cleaning up yourselves anyway, didn't you?
Well, you kept your own messes clean and things like that. But I can never remember seeing anyone on board the destroyer running about with a rifle. In the first place, you didn't have the space. And in those days, the quarter deck was the hallowed ground sort of thing, which you never, very seldom crossed in time of peace, except to go and do your, if you had any signals for the officers, you were hoisting the ensign. So I can't honestly say what any punishment was, whether you were put ashore or onto, and big ships, I believe, carried cells, which you could be put into.
You didn't have cells, anything like that, on the destroyer?
The only cells I can remember where it may have been would be, you'd probably have to ask a seaman, and the seaman would be in the tiller flat. That's where the electric motors for the... You know, you can't remember half the damn things. For the rudders were. And it was very noisy because you had the two screws coming from the propellers and electric motors and whatnot in there. And I reckon that was quite a punishment just to sit in there. I think that's the only place that I can remember. It was no use confining you to your ship because just the same as not going ashore. So that will come up later on as well. You had 8 o'clock in the morning in summer, 9 o'clock in winter. The duty signalman used to go down in number ones with another signalman to hoist the ensign. And the Union Jack, the Jack stay at the front. That was a bit of a ceremonial. The boss's mate piped 5 minutes to colours. You went down and you got the ensign all ready to lace it up and everything, but you didn't let it fly out, you held it in. There'd be the captain, the officer, the watch, and any officer there, and you had to watch the flagship, because they would have the marine band on playing the national anthem and whatnot, and you dare not be hoist your ensign in front of the flagship, never. That was a crime. You had to watch hers going up, and you had to judge it so that when the national anthem finished, it just got to the top, which was quite a feat, believe me. And everyone on board, if they were on the upper deck, when the colours were being, they used to face aft and salute. That is, if the buggers couldn't get out of sight in time. other little things, if you had your whaler away and you were going to sea, and the bosun mate come round, clear lower deck, hoist the whaler. If you'd seen some of the scuttering blokes hiding, it was easier to go and hoist, you know, you got the two ropes together. It was easier to go and do that than hide. I'll never know why. It was harder to hide than do the job. The signalman used to dash up to the bridge. The telegraphers into the wireless office. It was a... But the funny thing is, to this day, you never seem to bump into anyone. And the gangways are pretty narrow, the watertight doors are pretty narrow, and yet you never seem to bump into anyone. Why? I don't know. So that was my experiences in peacetime. Later on...
How many smaller boats? You mentioned the whaler. Were there any other small boats?
We had one whaler and one motorboat on the starboard side. One motorboat and what we called the skimming dish. It was like what you would call the RNLI's inshore little life, you know, the rubber dinghies. We had one of those. But it was wood, what we called the skimming dish. But that, you could, I think it only held the coxswain, who was a seaman, and one, maybe two more persons. But that was more or less, at the captain and officers. The motorboat, well, very seldom, the motorboat was used for taking liberty men. They had, I think, a stoker as a, to look after the engine, and two seamen. Peacetime was very ceremonial. He used to stand with his boat hook and go through all the manoeuvres and that.
What about mail? How was that organised? Because obviously you're in port, I suppose you could get your mail off.
Well, all mail for the Royal Navy is addressed to HMS so-and-so, care of the GPO in London. And they forward it. Oh, you got your mail quite regular. Later on, if you were, let's think now, we'll see, we, after the Thetis disaster, which you'll remember, we done various exercises with the fleet, and then we went to the Western Isles of Scotland. And when we got there, the mail was there. Later on, when you were going ships to Russia in the Atlantic, sometime it was 3 weeks before you got your mail. If you were lucky, if another flotilla come out to relieve you, or a cruiser come out, they would bring the mail with you. But very, very seldom. But the organisation for mail was pretty good in time of peace. It was just like the one of the coxswains used to go in the motorboat to the post office in Portland or Greenock and pick your mail up and bring it back and then come down through the mess decks, one for you and that, just flicked it at you, you know. That was pretty good.
And presumably, obviously, when you got to wartime, was your mail censored by the officers?
Yes. To the best of my knowledge, it was censored in a sense. It was only one at random. And I think, to the best of my knowledge, I think anything that may give any clue was a blue line through it. You had one privileged letter per week, which wasn't allowed to be censored. That was a wife, a husband to his wife, a mother, and things like that. And I don't think there was a lot of mail censored. I think they took you a lot on trust. Plus the fact that they would probably last mail at 9 o'clock. So the postman would go ashore, take the mail, the quartermaster, the boatswain. You'd probably sail at 10. Well, it didn't make much difference. You couldn't tell anybody where the hell you were going in any case. People had a good, a rough idea of where you were operating, you know, because you could see it's a bit cold here. They'd think, oh, he's up in Russia or something, you know. I don't think that any enemy ever get any advantage out of that sort of stuff, you know.
Did you have any Marines on board?
No. Actually, when the tribal class destroyers were first built, accommodation, to the best of my knowledge, was for 10 Marines, but it was dropped. I think Marines were just in cruisers and above, which they normally, I think, they used to man X turret, A, B, X, and Y. And of course, they had marine officers looking after their. But I think they were only used on big ships those days for ceremonial purposes. No, we never carried any marines, nothing like that at all.
And you mentioned the bosun piped you up for when you were raising the ensign. But during the day, were the messages through the communication system by piping, or?
Well, it was all done by piping, because we had nothing in those days like a public address system. Later on, we got it put into all the mess decks. This is the captain speaking, or we're going to. The second commanding officer was very good at giving you information, exceptionally good. But the bosun's mate working around, fallen for divisions, hands to tea, up spirits, special sea duty men, think that for various things like that. It was, he used to walk around with his little pipe round his, and for all of, I think that was a, good, really good. He went around all the mess decks, officers as well, they weren't exempt from calls and things like that, you know.
Was it a different tune, for want of a better word, for each particular call? They varied, in other words. You would know by the tune which one you were being given.
Well, I wouldn't know. To be honest, I was quite ignorant of that. I think you got different whistles for admirals coming on board and your own commanding officer. But to me, it was just a pipe. They all seemed the same, you know.
Right, well, we've covered the life in the ship pretty well. You arrive on the ship, and what happened to the ship then? How long were you in harbour?
Well, it all depends. If the commander chief decided he wanted to go and do an exercise, he would have destroyers, which in various forms, as he wanted it, cruising diagrams, and then we would have these imitation battles. We try find the cruisers, and they would try and dodge us and find us. Exercise like oil at sea. You know, go along, not go alongside. Go near enough alongside, and pass the hose pipe over, or trail it from the cruiser onto the destroyer, pick it up and connect it to your oil tanks. Subcaliber firing of your guns, firing at the drogue towed by the aircraft. It was all more or less exercises, night exercises, which, believe me, were a bit dodgy. And then the destroyers we might go and pay a courtesy visit to various. I'll go back to Weymouth to the fleet anchorage and be visited by Admiral whoever was coming down. Very seldom visited destroyers, usually cruisers and battleships and aircraft carriers. I'll take the carriers out for exercises. Whenever a carrier went to sea or peace and war, she always had an attendant destroyer, which she lay off astern in case of aircraft going over the side, you know, missing the arrestor wires to pick the pilot and navigator, etc. But it was mostly exercises until the war came along, and that changed everything considerably.
Well, awareness that war was coming must have been there at the time that you joined there, April, May.
Well, April and May. When it come May and June, well, 1938, there was a bit of a crisis, wasn't there, over Czechoslovakia, I believe. But 1939, you could see the sort of speeding up of training. And you've seen other personnel join your ship to make up a proper complement. And other personnel, like signalmen, depart. Because there were ships getting built that had to have staff, and they were taking one or two signalmen from each ship. And as I say, in the end, they were cut nearly in half, the signal departments. And of course, when the time of war did come, there was a lot of difference.
What do you recall of what you were doing from April onwards when you joined the ship? What was she doing? Where were you going? Were you involved in all these exercise businesses?
It was all exercises. Yes, exercises out into Atlantic, off the Norwegian coast, up around Iceland. It was more or less escorting the big ships. I can see the sense in it now, because it was essential they get, they had escorts for torpedo attacks when the war did eventually arrive. I didn't see it then. It was a bit of a nuisance to us to be following these damn big lumbering things around the ocean. But we had flotilla exercises and...
How many ships in a flotilla?
Eight.
That's quite a number. Eight destroyers all out.
Well, you got them all together in peacetime, but after that, you were made up with various... ships went for repairs, ships were sunk and things like that. You had a flotilla leader. That was Captain D. He was always a four-ring captain. And he carried all the elite on the flotilla leader. You know, the officers that were trained, the torpedoes, guns. And then you had a half leader. You had eight altogether, but you had a leader with had to part. And then, of course, when war came along, sometimes I don't think you ever got the whole flotilla together as an operational flotilla. You were made up with various different ships.
At what point did you get radar? When the war broke out?
Well, as you know, and people didn't know, radar went back, to the best of my knowledge, until 1936. I think it was the Rodney and the Sheffield. They were the only two ships. But we had radar fitted most destroyers when they went in for repair. About 41 had radar fitted. But the first radar we had fitted was rather today's radar was obsolete. It was a fixture on top of your mast. It didn't turn. So if you were falling in, you turned the whole ship. And then eventually we got the one that rotated. And gunnery, we had a big range finder on top of the director control tower. That was taken away. And on the top of the director tower, we had radar aerials which ranged. So there was quite a lot of changes then. And then that's when we started having radar operators on board, coders, because it was unnecessary for codes in peacetime. And that's when our complement started to go over the 200 and odd mark, you know.
Do you remember what you were doing, where you were when Chamberlain made that announcement on the Sunday morning, 3rd of September?
I can remember. Actually, we were paying a courtesy call on the Western Islands at Ullapool. And on the Friday night, I think half the flotilla was there. They could all have been there. On the Friday night, that would be the first of September, wouldn't it? Sunday was the third, wasn't it?
Yes, it was the Friday, yes, that was first.
On the Friday, they were going to give us a farewell dance. And later on, I'll show you the actual signals that were made. I've got a copy in my little locker there. And the first signal was the home fleet, either from the Admiralty or the commanding officer. I think it read, fuse all shells, ship all warheads, prepare for war. That was in the first. And of course, it was no farewell dance, up anchor, up to Scapa Flow, paint ship, cover all the gleaming metal work with grey so that it wouldn't shine on. And then September the 3rd was, I think it was, Germany, total Germany. That was war. No, that was, I'll show this, the two actual signals from that day. I've still they're getting a bit faded, but I've got them in my little locker.
How did you feel?
I don't think it made a great deal of difference. You've been trained for it. You know, everything you had done was working up to get your ship to the best efficiency you could get it to. I don't think you felt a great deal of difference. Of course, then again, we started escorting, going here, going there, and various...
When you say you went to Scapa Flow, what element of the fleet were already there or joined you?
Everything. I think with all the battleship we possessed, two or three aircraft carriers, which I think the Ark Royal was the only modern one. I think we had the Argus and a few of those really old ones, a couple of squadrons of cruisers, and I think we only had two flotillas of destroyers. We had the Tribals and another flotilla. And then, of course, we were there when the Royal Oak was sunk.
I was going to ask you, what are your memories of that?
Just panic. Everyone seemed to be dashing about, dropping depth charges and getting nowhere, to the best of my knowledge.
So presumably you were anchored there that
night? Well, we're tied up to the buoy. They're all buoys there. You don't use your anchor. The buoys are attached to big concrete blocks in the ocean, and you tie up to whatever buoy you're allocated to. And we just slipped and went looking for this submarine, which was a way back to sea.
So all was quiet and calm, and then presumably this explosion.
We never heard anything in the... You have a destroyer anchorage and a big ship anchorage. They're a few miles apart. We never heard anything until... I don't even remember what the signal was, but anyway, we got underway. I was still a junior signalman, and we got underway, we dropped a few charges, but I think we dropped them on wrecks, because there was still a lot of German wrecks from the First World War that had been sunk there, and that just calmed down, and the fleet went to sea, and we went down to Loch Hugh.
When you got up and weighed and did all of this, did you know what had happened? Had you been told what had happened?
No. After a few hours, because other than the emergency destroyers, it normally takes you from coal boilers, I believe, 2.5 to 4 hours to get enough steam to move. I think by that time we had a rough idea that something had happened. But of course, we'd had scares before in Scapa Flow with German reconnaissance aircraft, which you got the air raid warning yellow. That was for your pom-poms and then air raid warning red, where you closed everything up. So, not very often. We more or less kept at sea hunting.
But did it have any effect? No, goodness gracious, this is where men are being killed now. It's happened. A mile or so away from me, it's happened. Did that affect you in any? Did you think, this is we're now in the dangerous time. This is it.
No, I can't see it did. I suppose it did, but I suppose at the time we should have thought that could be us. And then it sounds ridiculous now, they started lobbing grenades over the side of all the ships. They were thinking about these human torpedoes and midget submarines and that. And the quartermaster used to lob about. Then we'd done exercises with submarines, trying to detect them, and they were trying to avoid us. And then when it was time for them to surface, you lobbed a couple of grenades over to make sure you weren't ram them.